Oh, another delightful morning. Everybody's happy. It is Tuesday, October 21st, 2025. For those who are watching this video in the after the apocalypse, the only thing that survives is YouTube. That would be interesting. Anyway. Yes, and that 2025 is how we refer to years at this time. It's based on an ancient religion that decided that that time started on the that the t in the year that the founder of the religion was born, although nobody really knows when they were born. Anyway, just trying to tell it like it is. All right, I'm wearing my Southern Dharma Retreat Center sweatshirt, for all those. We got a few people here who have been to Southern Dharma. I saw Carolyn before. Yep, she's disappeared from the screen. Well, anyway, there you go. Thanks, Carolyn. She pops up. All right, people, we're going to meditate for 20 minutes approximately, and then there will be more talking. So just settling in. Finding a way of sitting that supports your practice, supports mindfulness, supports a kindness toward yourself. As I often say, posture is really a key element of our practice. We can spend time with it, exploring it, understanding that the way we're sitting, the way we're holding our body affects our minds or our mental states. The best way to come to understand this is to notice the variations of your mental states as your postures change and as you try different postures. So, for instance, lying down will tend to create different mental states or be aligned with different mental states than sitting upright. Sitting rigidly will create different mental states from sitting gently. Slumping will tend to trigger certain states, while being upright will trigger others. In all of this, the Buddha's middle way is a good guide. What's a way that's comfortable but not too comfortable? That helps me to stay alert without getting rigid, helps me to relax without collapsing. Now, this is where posture becomes much more than just a formal aspect of practice, and actually becomes an integral part of our mindfulness. And in fact, in the Sutta on the Foundations of Mindfulness, this is one of the first things that the Buddha points to that we should bring awareness to. So naturally, out of awareness of posture comes a broader awareness of body and sensations. How does your body feel? What sensations are prevalent? Are there areas of numbness, areas of excitation? And from this broader awareness of body, we draw in closer to bring awareness to the breath. And how do we bring awareness to the breath? We focus on sensations. Ideally, or at least initially, we choose a point of sensation, typically the nostrils, where you would feel the air, or the belly, where you would feel movement. And so we choose one of these areas of sensation as a focal point. This is not an attempt to shut out thinking or other elements of experience, other sense impressions, but just to gradually train the mind and train the attention to sustain itself and to direct it to a particular place intentionally, instead of having our attention at the whim of impulse, craving, distraction. And the first aspect of breath that we apply our attention to is the distinction between the in-breath and the out-breath. And so now we are dividing the breath into two parts: breathing in, breathing out, and noticing the specific sensations that are present with those two activities. And there may still be thoughts moving through the mind. That's okay. But if you completely lose touch with the breath, then when you realize that, gently come back and start again. In simple terms, this is our practice, a practice of returning, returning to the breath. Training the mind. However, the mind is not like a pet animal you can train in such a simple way. Human mind is more complex. At times, as we try to follow this simple exercise, powerful feelings may arise, or intrusive thoughts, thoughts that are disturbing to the mind, to our heart. And in those cases, we break our attention, open the eyes, remove the body. Letting these energies move through, holding them with kindness. This certainly isn't the regular experience, but not uncommon. We should not become too attached to a form, thinking that having our eyes closed, sitting absolutely still, is some ideal to strive for. But to learn to care for ourselves, to respond to whatever's arising in a gentle, considerate way. Without striving, we can nonetheless use the breath as a calming tool. As we exhale, we soften and release through the body, sensing the nervous system if it's in an excited state. Having a sense of releasing, settling, grounding. These are the ordinary tools for calming. At times we need the opposite. We need the stimulating energies of the in-breath. If we are getting drowsy or dull, the mind is getting dull, then as we inhale, we Strengthen or bring up the posture a bit, opening the chest, opening the heart with the sense of energy rising through the spine. Can use a smile in this process, in the effort to raise energy, a brightening. So again, we are working with the concept of a middle way, balancing energies, and attuning to what's called for in any moment. So this attention itself, attention to the energetic states, increases our concentration and focus naturally. We don't have to strive for concentration. Simply investigate our experience with curiosity, with care, concentration naturally then grows out of this effortlessly. All right, morning again. Got the traditional scratchy throat. So I talked a little bit more than I usually do and may have picked up on some of the different themes there. There were a couple of guided meditations at the Buddhist Recovery Network Summit this past weekend, and I thought they were very skillfully presented. And I've been reading about trauma, and what do they call it? Trauma-informed mindfulness, trauma something. But anyway, being aware of mindful of trauma when you're teaching mindfulness, which for an old person, it's like new. Oh no. I don't like new, different. But it's interesting, and I thought that, and I know some of you are meditation teachers, so if you didn't see those guided meditations, I think they are available, or they shortly will be available to watch. I think you'd find them useful just to watch. They're just presented in a very skillful way. And what I noticed about them was that before the guided meditation started, each teacher on Saturday, it was Mikey Livid from the Wild Heart in Nashville, and on Sunday it was Dalila Bothwell, who teaches Buddhist recovery for the Insight Meditation Society online. And each of them spent a fair amount of time talking about the practice before they taught it, which is a way of preparing people so that they're not like feel so that they have a sense of safety when they go into the process, like I know what's going to happen. I thought that was very skillful, and it's just interesting to look at these ideas that I'm always kind of a crank about when I see some a movement and like everybody's kind of getting on board with the movement, and I become skeptical very quickly. So the trauma movement to me has become a bit of has taken over in a way that I think winds up trivializing trauma in a way. It's like, statistics say that 90% of people have had trauma, and well, then just it isn't. I don't think that helps anybody because it's just like saying dukkha. It's everybody has, birth is suffering, birth is trauma, aging is trauma, death is trauma, and so then people who have experienced severe things like, rape and the violence of war and physical abuse, mental abuse, emotional abuse, being exposed to having terrible things happen, terrible car accidents, just all, there are many things that are obviously have a real devastating impact on on people's psyche. And that's very different from, your parents didn't let you have dessert or something. I'm sorry, I don't want to again trivialize, but, to me, being human is difficult, no doubt. And this practice can make you even more sensitive to your inner pain. It's ironic, but that's part of what happens. As people in recovery, we know like denial is not being aware of what's happening. And this is why early recovery is the hardest part, because suddenly you are aware of the pain that you've been avoiding feeling and avoiding acknowledging or running from, or all the ways that we've been dealing with it in unwholesome and unhelpful ways. And now we're just stuck with it. And so that's one of the reasons, I think the main reason why people relapse in the early stages of recovery is that they are faced with their own pain. And the whole, the reason we were using was because we didn't know how to handle that. And so the same, then meditation and mindfulness is a deeper way of engaging in life than just cutting out drugs and alcohol. You've cut out drugs and alcohol, and now you're going to look. Now you're going to feel. Now you're just going to be quiet. You're not going to distract yourself. You're not going to stay busy. You're not going to entertain yourself. You're just going to sit and be with the experience of being a human being, which is by nature, as the Buddha tells us, difficult and in fact painful. Dukkha. So I think I've always thought of my practice as engaging with what's now called trauma. I just don't think I called it that, I just called it like, this feelings, feelings. In any case, it is interesting. I've been reading, and I just, I use this class as just my opportunity to just talk every week, and you guys keep showing up, and if you want me to be different, you have to tell me. I can try to be different. I don't mean be a different person, but talk about different things, Anyway, it's just like I'm just telling you what's going on. And it is true that as a Buddhist teacher and author, I am in an ongoing process of trying to learn and communicate. And so I hope that each week I have something worth sharing. So coming back to what I was about to say, as I'm working on my latest writing project, I'm doing a lot of reading, as I suggested, the David Treleaven's book on trauma-informed mindfulness. But the one that I really like, which is really actually a good book as a writer, I like, there are things that are informative and then there are good books. The Body Keeps a Score is a good book. You can read it and not get bored. It's like interesting and entertaining. As I've been talking a lot over the past, whatever, a couple years about energies in the body, and then I started to narrow that down recently to like the nervous system, and then I'm then going and looking at the stuff that Rick Hansen has written about, and it's actually what's interesting for me as a practitioner is starting to attune a little bit more. My practice has long been focused on the felt experience in the body that's directly connected to emotions and is tied into the nervous system. And mostly I've done that in a non-verbal and not trying to identify what the science of what's happening or the physiology of it, but just what it's like sitting here with my eyes closed and feeling these things moving and seeing how my mind goes with those things and the moods that shift and the things that are just sensed as more physical, and then the things that seem to be like related to something I'd call emotional, and then the mental things that come out of that, and that whole process, which is in and of itself powerful, profound, and vital, and really the most important thing I may have done with my life. I don't know, but starting to sort of see the actual physiology of it and neurophysiology and all of that is quite interesting. I kind of like started to tune in. I don't even know how to say the word, the vagal, I guess the vagal nerve. It's like this thing that just runs through your whole body, right? And realizing that a lot of those little flashes of anxiety and the different things that appear in different parts of the body. Sometimes, and as you know, a lot of you are very experienced meditators, you have an experience and you feel something like here, or you feel something over here, or you feel something down there, you feel something in your leg, and you're realizing like, oh, that's all, there's all this one long nerve that's like shooting off, that's kind of firing off at certain moments. As a certain thought appears, an anxiety, a sadness, an anger, a resent, whatever, and then you're being more mindful. You're sitting with it. You feel ting, and it's like oh, and you just breathe, and you're not like oh, that's my vagal nerve sending blah blah blah. You're just like oh, there's a sensation. You know, breathe, release, let it go. But it is interesting to see all this as systemic. And, you know, I certainly don't think that that's the most important thing to explore, because I think that easily takes you out of the experience into the mental realm of thinking about what's happening, analyzing what's happening. Thinking, because what we're, you know, what we, this human tendency is, if I can capture something mentally, then I'm in control of it. If I know it, or if I understand it, and if I have words for it, and really, that to me is not really, that isn't real knowing. The knowing in the body is actually much more important, which maybe that's why the title of the book, The Body Keeps the Score, rather than The Mind Keeps the Score. I will say, you know, so I ramble on here, that, you know, these books are all about trauma, you know, trauma-sensitive mindfulness and body keeps score, and you have Peter Levine and or Levine, I'm just saying Levine because Stephen Levine. Anyway, and that's not what I'm interested in. you know, what I'm working on and writing about is depression. And it's interesting, and maybe there's something out there. It probably is somewhere. But I don't know if there's a popular book that takes apart depression the way we're taking apart trauma in this way. Because it's the same body and it's the same system. And it just manifests in a different way and it has different causality. But it's still running off all these, you know, the nervous system and the parasympathetic and the sympathetic nervous system and the vagal nerve and it's all still. And the hormones and all that stuff, it's all using the same elements. It's just that trauma has become the thing that people have, you know, focused on in that regard. So I'm trying to write a book that's gonna, it's not gonna do the same thing because I'm not a scientist and I'm not doing research, but it's gonna try to, we'll see if this happens. I'm not guaranteeing this book will ever, you know, be finished, but that tries to sort of take this stuff and take apart depression in its multi facets and offer practices for working with it. I don't. I don't usually do research when I write a book. Most of my books have just come out of my experience. But as I started to work on this, I have felt the gaps in my knowledge, and that I did want to be able to understand what the sense experiences were in physiological terms and neurological terms, and to be able to take that apart and talk about it intelligently. Well, one of the things that's difficult, and I've talked about this a little bit before, is that it's very triggering to read about this stuff and to write about it, and it's one of the reasons why I think I'm in a somewhat dysregulated state right now. See, I'm learning to the language, dysregulated. Ooh, I sound so modern. Oh, in the old days, it would just said it's one of the reasons I'm so fucked up right now. But it does sometimes. I do like this language though, because it does take it out of, it's not judgmental, right? Dysregulated isn't, fucked up is like, there's something wrong with me. What's wrong with me? I shouldn't be this way. Dysregulated is like, oh, it's just, there's an energetic state that's out of balance. So I appreciate that language. But it's just, I guess I have to pull back again because I feel very self-conscious just speaking in this way. And because every week, every Tuesday morning, I sit here and I really, I do what I do in my writing, which is I try to teach out of my experience. And a couple things about that. One is belief is that none of my experiences are unique or limited to Kevin. And so that therefore human experiences are more universal. And so if I explore my own personal experience, it will have value beyond, and share that, it can have value beyond my own, self-examination and sort of therapy. And I suppose, the relative success of the work I do speaks to that. At the same time, I don't have every experience. My experience isn't the same as everyone else's. And so this is why for me, like reading about and understanding teachings on trauma is helpful, because I don't think that I've experienced trauma on a level that has deeply imprinted on me. But clearly many people have. And if I'm going to be useful as a Dharma teacher, then I need to understand things beyond my own experience. And I mean, maybe that's pretty obvious for a Dharma teacher, but I just want to respect that and say that I don't expect that everything I share about my own experience is necessarily going to resonate for people. And there will be spots where you're like, oh no, for me, it's not that. And so maybe at least what I share can be viewed in contrast to someone else's experience. That if we're trying to help each other, that part of what we do is compare, and so if it doesn't match up, then Hopefully you're able to go, oh, well, that's not me, I'm this. So it, maybe that reveals something. Well, I guess, have I spoken enough? Well, I guess I have for now. I know you guys will get me going if I open it up. So I just want the one thing that's difficult about today, particularly, is that we didn't get 40 people, and my self-worth is really dependent upon 40 people being in this. And that, of course, I understand that when we get to 40, that still includes me, so it's really only 39, but I don't think about it that way. I just think it's 40, okay, I'm a success. My worth is affirmed. So if you could like call a friend or something to maybe log on, that would really help me. Okay, sorry. Deborah, hey.
Good morning, Kevin. Thank you for being part of BRN last weekend. That was really special. I did appreciate the intros and the offers of help before the meditations. It was nice that people needed it because in the previous
Yeah.
BRN Zooms, it was needed and wasn't exposed. But what I'd like to say today is that your vulnerability is always valued. And I think that gives a lot of hope to people that need it, who've had more traumatic experiences than you have, just because it shows strength. And a lot of times, seeing strength like that to just be out there gives hope. And hope is a valued commodity in the world. And I think like the No Kings rallies around the country and around the world prove that. And
Yeah.
that's a lot of what we have to live on in this day and age. So thank you.
Very sweet. Thank you. Thanks, Deborah. Appreciate it. Mike, hi. Speaking up at the beginning, this is go ahead.
Yeah, well, I just have been thinking about a few things. So hi, Kevin. Hey, everybody. Yeah, I was gonna say, you were reflecting on your teaching style and kind of wondering a little bit about how effective it's been and everything. And I really appreciate your authenticity and just speaking from the heart. I mean, it's what we all try to do in our recovery meetings, so it's a good example to set. I mean, people who over prepare and think too hard about it, I mean, sometimes they're great and sometimes it comes across as not very authentic, but I really appreciate that. I mean, on the good days, it's great, and on the days where you're struggling a little bit, well, you got a meditation in and maybe a laugh or two.
Yeah,
So
good.
anyway, thanks so much. And I was also going to thank you. Today's my 7th sobriety anniversary day. And
Hey.
just oh, thanks. I just to let you know that you and the rest of the Sangha here, you're really doing good work. I mean, it maybe seems kind of rote sometimes, but it really is helping people, and it's a life and death kind of situation for some of us. So we really appreciate it. And I just hope I don't go on too long. Cut me
No.
off if I do, but
Go for it.
I went up to Metaphoris this weekend with some
Huh?
college students from Dharma Bums. Some of the people here know about Dharma Bums. I think I saw another bum here, Anne. Hi, Anne. And anyway, there's an association with some college students. I went up there with them, and we got to do the alms ceremony, and the students got to hang out, and we the chanting while the monks ate, and then we ate, and we helped them do some volunteer work, and it turned out to be some pretty sizable volunteer work. And most of the students left early, but a couple of us stayed. And Tanisiro Biko, Tan Jeff, gave us kind of a private meditation afterwards. So it was really cool. I really enjoyed it. But what I was gonna kind of say was it kind of fits in with what you were talking about. He said something that I don't, you don't hear this wave too much in recovery, but he was talking about, our mind is our own responsibility, and we need to learn to be responsible for it. And it just kind of hit me that it kind of fits in with our recovery and learning to meditate and learning to deal with our, our feelings and our pains and everything else. And I just thought you might have a comment or two, might stir some thoughts.
That's great. And just for people to know, like Mike is in San Diego and he's talking about the Metta Monastery, Metta Forest Monastery, which is founded by Thanissaro Bhikkhu, also known as Tan Jeff, who's really a leading translator of the Pali Canon and really a senior teacher in the Thai forest tradition. Well, it makes me think about or it what came up was Claude Anshin Thomas, who spoke at the Buren conference this weekend, who, when I interviewed him for a podcast recently, said you can't teach people to meditate. And it's kind of that ultimately that's right. You give guidance, but the inner experience, we have to figure it out for ourselves. We have to navigate it ourselves. And it's something whenever I teach meditation, I'm trying to help people to engage in that way, to not to use meditation, not to think that meditation is following a series of steps, but rather that you have to learn to observe your own mind and your own body and your own feeling states. And then you have to learn how to work with them, manage them, respond to them, and you watch how they're operating, how they're playing off each other, and that whole thing. And we have the Dharma and the Buddhist teachings to give us some guidelines about right effort and the hindrances and ways of kind of, understanding what's happening and categorizing what's happening. But it's still all done on this nonverbal experiential level that can only be done through your own inner work. And there's no one can do it for you. And no one can te really tell you how to do it. That's not that meaningful. Ultimately, it's all about the experience. So that would be my response, which I hope aligns with what you're thinking.
No, thanks, Kevin. That's what I was trying to say. So, thanks.
Beautiful. Thanks, Mike. Good work. Leslie.
Hi, nice to be
Hi.
here. When you said the word dysregulated, it kind of made me laugh, and I've been thinking so much lately about how movies and TV shows, it's all they get dysregulated. They It's automatically I need a drink, and how
Right.
programmed I am at a very young age to think that that's going to be the answer to all my problems, and
Yeah.
in the moment. But I guess it'd be kind of boring if the movie was like, I need to meditate, I could sit there and they would do nothing for a minute, but I wish they would get
Yeah.
some sort of different little ideas. And that's what this is all about, finding other tools besides running to food or, being aware of what's going on in the body. And I just wanted to say how it must be really difficult to cover all your bases. Like, you don't want to offend anybody, but you're kind of like, because I'm a server in my life too, and I don't, I kind of like depend on people giving me money every day, and I don't want to offend anybody and try to be nice. And I just realize that how hard it must be for you sometimes to, cover all your bases, and that I really do appreciate you. That's all.
Thank you. I one of the reasons I'm not a spirit rock teacher is because I do not cover all my bases and I do offend people. So I decided a long time ago that I'd rather have a small community that in which I could be fully myself or feel, at least, reasonably fully myself, then I would want to be like out there and everybody loves me and I'm a phony, or that I can't really, this is where commercializing the Dharma becomes a problem when we don't want to offend anyone. The Dharma is inherently offensive, in some way, in the sense that it's saying life kind of sucks and you got to figure out a way to deal with it, and it's up to you, like kind of, I don't know. And recovery is the same way, right? Like it's like, no, like I'm sorry, like you're fucking up, like you deal with it, it's there's like the easier, softer way, right? No, it doesn't work. So,
Thank you.
yeah, thanks, Leslie. Steve Jones.
Well, that's been a very interesting conversation. Wow. You are very authentic, Kevin, and you know how much you have helped me over the years. And the lie I was hearing, I could tell just by, I know you well enough that I can tell when you're speaking, and I can see that you're having some struggles with what you want to say. And I believe that we're all pretty good at beating ourselves up and evaluating and all that. But ever since COVID hit, I have not missed a single day of meditation. And I can tell you that when I came to you as a meditation and a Dharma teacher, I was kind of lost. I didn't know what to do, how to do it. But over this past 5 years, I have gotten to the point now with my practice that I've gotten very involved with Dr. Joe Dispenza from the Gaia Sphere, and I gotten been very much involved. This weekend, I spent they had the channeling conference at the Gaia Sphere, and that was live streamed. Incredible stuff when you listen to people channel. But for me, I've gotten to a point now where my sits, I every morning I sit for 2 hours. It's kind of like that's what I want to do, and that's what I need to
Nice.
do because it takes me at least an hour to kind of warm up. So you go through all that process of you have that bad thought and you go, oh shit, and you freak out, and then you, oh, okay, it'll go away, it's impermanent. But I attribute what I'm experiencing in life right now to the fact that I show up here every Tuesday, and I learn from you, and I get the lessons and all the people that are here every Tuesday. It is a small community, it's a small sangha, but we love each other, we care about Mother Earth. And look, at as far as trauma, I don't really recall having any really in-depth, serious, deep trauma. My dad was good with the belt, so I mean that was, I guess
Yeah,
that was
does that
traumatic,
count? Yeah.
but I suffer more trauma just from what's going on Mother Earth than anything. It's like it's
Yeah,
constant.
it's
So my
true.
practice is it's mandatory for me, and I just want to thank you for what you do, and I love you dearly, and I'm growing in ways that I never thought would ever happen for me at this stage of my life. So thank you.
Thanks, Steve. My mother had the airbrush, but so that was, Monica, let's take it out.
I'm there with everybody else, but I love the f I feel very grateful for the to be of service, here to the Sangha. But I think your endearing qualities, which makes your message land so easily, is you're so approachable and so authentically you, which you don't, which so we get to know you. You have the Buddhist monks that sit very still and very straight, and you think they never have a thought in their life, but we feel like, and I think maybe in for some of us that's a good way to learn, so. And I've had a lot of trauma growing up. I don't need to get into it. Lots of work and lots of forgiveness, but and I have read The Body Keeps the Score. I have this really strange experience now when I'm meditating. When I was in when my granddaughters were born in Oregon, they're now in Colorado, but they're 2 and a half. They're twins. I went out to Oregon, and my son wanted to go look at a property. It had lots of land, this really crappy house on it. I mean, we're talking rotten foundation, but they paid a lot of money to have somebody stage the house. And they had all these little deer heads and they had painted them white and they have little beads hanging on them. And they were like
God.
all over, they had this one wall. I mean, it was a lot of money. You could tell it's been highly staged.
Right.
Every time I sit down to meditate, it's been 2.5 years. I'll sit down to meditate and those damn deer heads pop in. And I'm going like, why are you here? You
Why are they
know? And
here?
so I'm t so I, but eventually, they go away. Like Steve says, eventually everything kind of just sits. But I'm going like, what's with the deer heads? So maybe they were trauma, maybe they traumatized me. I don't know. Maybe it's my favorite animal. I don't know. Yeah, but.
Jeez, Monica, you can't just leave us with that. You don't have any insight or conclusion. You need to give us something here. That's just.
But there's, but it does keep coming. It with like clockwork. Yeah, Steve's laughing. Like clockwork. That's what. That's that. That image is somehow burned in. So I don't know
Isn't it
why.
strange? I guess you're referring to like trauma, but it wasn't trauma, but somehow it got stuck. I mean,
Maybe that's and because of, I have all this brain injury stuff and the PTSD, but I feel like all that's pretty managed now. And but I mean, maybe that's that just is a thing, and eventually within a couple of minutes it goes away. But I'm like, why are you here? Do I wanted it to leave, and
It's a mystery, right?
it's quite the mystery. Yes, it is.
I mean, I think about like when I'm on retreat, a lot of music will play in my head, and one of the weird things, so sometimes like a song will start and I'll be like, after a while, I'm like, why did that song start? And very occasionally, I've been able to realize that some word or phrase passed through my mind, and it was a lyric, or it was similar to a lyric, and then it just immediately triggered on to the song. And so it's really interesting. This is what one of the things that's so interesting about watching the mind and how our minds are. This is just one of those things. I think it's in that book, are meaning-making machines. And I've heard that phrase before. And that we don't like the concept. We don't want to view the world as a random place. So we always want to make meaning or make connections out of everything we experience. And so, a word appears in the mind and it reminds you of a lyric, and then you're singing the song, and then you feel like, oh, right, it's this song as me, whatever, and yeah, so there's some, I mean, it's interesting, that's the story you told. What stayed with me was the foundation, the rotting foundation, and the image. I mean, it's such a great image, right? Of like this false front, this staging of something that's actually collapsing. I mean, it's a very there's a lot of poetry and metaphor in that imagery. So if there's anything that I would think was getting triggered, it's that to me, because that the deer are just the manifestation of the fake staging that trying to cover up the rotting
Oh,
foundation.
what is it that I don't like that
So
expression
I've just
either.
analyzed it for you,
Oh,
so
thank you. Thank you.
it's my Jungian background,
Oh, I love it. I love it. Yeah. Do you get a
which I don't have.
certification in that too?
Yeah, I probably should get that. Yeah, I might just
Yeah,
certify
good. You
myself,
and I are in.
self-certified.
Self-certified. Well, I'm certifiable, but that's all. Oh, questionable. Thank you. That actually is really interesting.
Well, you guys, it's 11:08 here in Northern California, which is, I've given 8 minutes away for free.
We see all those smiles you got, all that laughter,
Well,
all those smiles.
you know, the best comment in the, as I hope you saw in the chat, was if you count the cats, it's 40. And that's not anybody counting Kate's dog. So like now we're up, you
Well,
know.
my dog was right here too. Ginger was
Yeah,
watching.
so really we're way, and
We're
then
way over
yeah,
40.
yeah,
My dog's here too, so you're
okay, I feel much better.
We love you, Kevin. Have a
Okay,
great
love you
day.
guys.
Go play
Thank
wild
you.
golf. Animals love meditation, by the way.
Yeah.
I'll come running in. Okay. Many
All
blessings.
right.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right. Okay. Good. All right.
Thanks,
Keep the faith, peace, love,
Kevin.
compassion.
So
All
it was
right.
funny at the end of the meditation with Tan Jeff. There were just me and two students in this whole hall,
Wow.
and he looked right at me and he goes, "Are there any questions?"
Yeah.
I had all these questions, but no way in hell was I saying a word.
Oh, but that's such a great opportunity. All right.
Oh yeah, it was, and I just knew that it would turn into a whole thing, and somehow I'd get
He's
tired
pretty
of
tough. He's pretty tough. He's
it. Oh, he's totally tough.
yeah, he's not easygoing.
No, the way he did that whole guided the meditation, and you're responsible for your own minds, and it was a tough meditation, And I was just like, with just the three of us, it was like, oh gosh, I was so afraid of. I wanted to ask a question, but I didn't quite have the balls to.
Yeah,
Anyway.
fair.
Yeah.
All right, take care, Mike. Congratulations on 7 years. That's awesome.
Thanks.
Keep it up. Yep.
Bye bye.
Bye.